Case number 20-6097, Ruth Chelf versus Prudential Insurance Company et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Grabhorn for the appellant.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Grabhorn. I represent appellant Ruth May Chelf in this matter. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal if that's fine.
Fine.
Thank you. Can you all hear me okay too?
Yes. Okay.
This case presents a fairly straightforward matter, and that's whether the district court erred in granting appellee's 12B6 motion to dismiss on Ms. Chelf's ERISA 502A3 breach of fiduciary duty claim, where no discovery had been conducted and where questions of fact were present. On a motion to dismiss, Ms. Chelf was not required to prove each element of her claim, but instead was only required to plead allegations with respect to each of the elements. Ms. Chelf has more than met that minimal burden. Here, the only claim Ms. Chelf has asserted against appellees, if I refer to them collectively, it'll be as Walmart for simplicity. The only claim here is for breach of fiduciary duty. Under this court's precedent, on a motion to dismiss, Ms. Chelf is not required to prove each of the elements, but again, must simply provide factual allegations that contain either direct or inferential allegations respecting each material element. Relevant here, those elements are that the defendant Walmart is a planned fiduciary, that Walmart breached its fiduciary duty, and the breach resulted in harm to the plaintiff. With respect to each of these, as the first element that Walmart is a planned fiduciary, Ms. Chelf pleaded this fact, and in fact, Walmart did not dispute the element before the trial court. In fact, the 2016 RAP document, which Walmart relied upon on its motion to dismiss, confirmed that the administrative committee is the named fiduciary of the plan. At a minimum, the issue of whether or not a Walmart is a plan fiduciary is a question of fact. It's under a Sixth Circuit precedent, cases Fowler v. National Latex Products, PFAHLER 517-530-816. As to the third element, whether Walmart's action or inaction harmed Ms. Chelf, the district court correctly found that, and I'm quoting here, the complaint contains facts regarding Walmart's defendant's alleged misrepresentations and omissions that harmed plaintiff. Again, the third element here is not in dispute. Lastly, the second element is the only one that is in dispute. That is whether Walmart breaches fiduciary duties. In Ms. Chelf's complaint, she enumerated a number of ways in which Walmart breaches fiduciary duties to both her and her late husband, Mr. Chelf, including failing to disclose to Mr. Chelf that he had a right to convert his term life insurance, failing to timely remit and to apply Mr. Chelf's associate term life insurance premium payments, failing to apply Mr. Chelf's unpaid time off to any past due term life insurance premiums, failing to advise Mr. Chelf that he could apply his unpaid time off to any outstanding premiums, failing to comply with ERISA's regulatory requirements, including the obligation to notify Mr. Chelf of an adverse decision, and failing to convey complete and accurate information material to Mr. Chelf's circumstances. As with the other elements, whether Walmart did, in fact, breach its fiduciary duty is a question of fact that is not properly resolved at the motion dismiss stage where sufficient factual allegations exist.
Of that list, it seems to me that there are a couple of categories there. Some relate to claims of notice and information, which might fall within the Sprague case. But my understanding is that a number of them simply have to do with a fiduciary use of funds, disposition and control and management of plan assets. Is that a fair statement of the claims?
I think that's a fair statement of easy way to categorize the number of different ways there. One, like you hit on there, goes to the Sprague case, and I believe the Vest case, which opposing counsel will talk about, that goes into conversion rights. And here I'd note that this policy actually does require a written notice. And then the second area, kind of what you're going along with, is premium payments. Here, the documents that Walmart itself produced in regards to the plan show that when there is unpaid leave that can be payable to a participant, then Walmart has taken on the obligation themselves to remit premiums from that payment. So in essence, when you're dealing with premiums, obviously you're dealing with the plan assets and the funding mechanisms of the plan itself. So long answer, short question. Yes, I believe that's a fair characterization.
And how do the appeal documents that that occurred below, how do they fit within your analysis?
I think I would, right now, I don't know that they're exactly relevant because just as the lower court said on a motion to dismiss those documents, if they're going to be considered, we'd have to sit there and take them for the truth of the matter asserted. And that's not proper here on a motion to dismiss where all the facts must be taken as true. I would note that in reviewing those, one of the letters, in fact, recognized, and this is docket 18-8, page ID 964, the letter actually referenced the fact that Walmart recognized it had an obligation to remove, or that Mr. Chelf could have told them to remove these premium payments from his unpaid time off. They simply never told him that fact beforehand and just let the policy lapse due to lack of premium payment.
I'm a little confused. I'm sorry, this may be a very dense question, but if it's unpaid leave, what would they be removing premium payments from?
It'd be unpaid leave for, I believe, a lot of his was vacation pay that they would owe him at some later time. And in fact, in this letter that I just referenced, they said that, sorry, I'm looking away from you, but I'm just so I can read this for you.
Sure.
Premiums totaling 27, they say you're terminated and 36.4 remaining hours were paid out for the pay period of May 14th through May 27th. They don't identify exactly what that pay was for, but my guess is vacation pay, sick pay, something that he accumulated through his employment there. Premium payments totaling $27.66 were automatically deducted from this check. So the point being that when these amounts are payable or due to Mr. Chelf or any of the Walmart employees for that matter, then premium payments can necessarily be deducted therefrom. And at a minimum, had Mr. Chelf known of this issue or Walmart had told him of this issue, then he could have easily told them and directed them to remit the premium payments from his unpaid leave vacation time. Again, without a lot of discovery, it's hard for me to say exactly what those hours are related to.
Is that a failure to provide information claim, or is that a breach of plan document or plan responsibilities claim?
I think it's I think it almost falls within both, but again, I think it's a failure to one, properly control plan assets more than anything, because that's essentially what they're doing when they're handling premiums is they're controlling what happens to the plan assets themselves. And in effect, by way of example, one of the other allegations, because we're just talking about how they're kind of lumped into two categories, one of the other ones that falls in there had to do with his LTD and STD premiums. And while Walmart wants to sit there and say that they those premiums aren't waived while you're on disability, the actual policies themselves say otherwise. And so in effect, when they're dealing with those premiums similar to here, and they're requiring Mr. Chelf to pay for those premiums, what they're doing is they're holding on to a plan asset that they shouldn't have for their own benefit. They're enriching themselves at Mr. Chelf's defense. And at a minimum, with those STD and LTD payments that they were making, or that he was making out of the funds, those could have easily been also remitted to pay for any life insurance premiums that he was due or owed.
You know, what do you have to say about the problem you seem to have that with regard to Walmart's failure to provide notice of your client's right to convert the policy, that you forfeited that argument in the district court?
I disagree with his argument on that point, because what the argument was made below at the lower court. The issue here is, I believe you're referring to Mr. Howard's comments, I think, when he pointed to the fact that we didn't cite to the policy itself or the plan itself. And again, it's because we were on a motion to dismiss. We were not obligated to sit there and put forward every piece of evidence we have because we hadn't completed or even begun discovery yet. Walmart attached the some plan documents, which the court considered, but at that time we didn't have the policy. We didn't have the actual plan. While we received it later, it was after the court had already dismissed our claim with prejudice. The argument was made below, and even if there was any sort of waiver, the waiver might relate to reliance upon that specific plan document, the policy itself. But in essence, at a minimum, it shines light on the lack of, it shows that we needed discovery to go forward so that we could all know exactly what plan documents, what plan terms, what actually controlled here.
Of course, when you found out about this problem, you didn't ask the court to reconsider. And I think this was prior to the entry of judgment. Based on rule, or if judgment had been entered based on rule 59 or rule 60, you didn't attempt to provide argumentation to the court on this issue.
And again, Your Honor, this is one of those where it was kind of it was one of those weird procedural ones where you try and find the rule or the case that tells you exactly what to do, because what we had was the court dismissed our claims with prejudice. And then I believe Walmart sought 54 relief to make it final and appealable. We didn't oppose that motion. In fact, we went ahead and filed the notice of appeal once the court entered the order. Then when we came to the Sixth Circuit, we got a show cause order. Sixth Circuit remanded us back down, so there wasn't an issue for the court to decide as of yet. And then when we went back, it was one of those we didn't really know where we were at. But ultimately, it's to use the old adage, it's the tail wagging the dog, because the conversion aspect is only one of the components here. The other ones go to, Judge Stranch was talking about, is that other category dealing with premiums and the funding of the plan and handling of the plan assets that inherently is a fiduciary function. That answer do?
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And I'll just end with this again, whether or not any of these actions were a fiduciary function or whether or not Walmart was acting as a fiduciary in administering any of these issues is a question of fact that goes to the Henry Unisys case from the Third Circuit, which James Eve Pirelli adopted, as well as Dundenhofer adopted as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Howard.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to move back here to the table that I have set up. May it please the court, Judge Clay, Judge Moore, and Judge Stranch, good afternoon. My name is Gordon Howard, and I represent the defendants, appellees, Administrative Committee for the Associates Health and Welfare Plan and Walmart Associates, Inc. Can you hear me okay, Your Honors?
Yes.
Thank you. Appellees believe that the district court correctly interpreted the applicable DOL regulations and precedent from this court in holding that the Walmart defendants were not subject to fiduciary liability for the alleged wrongful acts giving rise to the complaint. There is no dispute that Walmart, Inc. is the employer plan sponsor and that the administrative committee is the named fiduciary and plan administrator of the Associates Health and Welfare Plan. As Mr. Grabhorn noted, there are three essential elements in determining whether a entity is liable for fiduciary acts or omissions. Here, I disagree a little bit with Mr. Grabhorn in that I think that the court focused on the first element, which is whether the defendant was acting in a fiduciary capacity, but it made the alleged or challenged misrepresentations or omissions. And while Walmart defendants assert that plaintiff cannot establish any of the aforementioned elements, the district court, as I mentioned, focused on the first. In evaluating the first element, the district court looked first to the Department of Labor's interpretive bulletin, which is found at 29 CFR section 2509.75-8D2. Now, I know that's a long citation.
Why does that apply to Walmart in the form of its administrative committee?
The reason is, Your Honor, that courts, including this one, have, and actually in a decision authored by Judge Clay, or the Bailey versus U.S. Enrichment Corporation, have typically looked to whether a fiduciary, what actions they were taking with respect to the claims in the complaint to determine whether or not fiduciary liability applied to those actions.
I have no disagreement with the issue of it matters what hat you're wearing. Remember, the early case law used to talk about whether you're wearing your fiduciary hat or wearing your corporate hat. I understand that distinction completely. But you're relying on a regulation that applies by its own terms only to persons who lack the power to make decisions on plan policy, interpretation, practices, and procedures, and engage in minor administrative functions. That's not Walmart or its administrative committee, in my estimation. So why would that CFR apply in this case?
Well, I think it's important to note that the plan or the component benefit at issue here is a life insurance benefit, which is fully insured by Prudential. So while, yes, Walmart does have discretionary authority in some respects to the plan at large, with respect to the life insurance benefits at issue, they have primarily a ministerial function. It is Prudential that wrote and drafted the policy that Mr. Grabhorn references. It's Prudential that made all benefit determinations with respect to the policy. It's Prudential that sets forward the premium rates and determines, you know, what those are based on its own actuarial standards. And it's Prudential that has all the discretion with respect to that policy.
I hate to interrupt you, but didn't Walmart have some authority with regard to whether to provide whether notice should have been given to the employee regarding the right to convert the insurance plan? The district court said that Walmart was not a fiduciary, but if Walmart had authority or power over allocation of premiums and that kind of thing, then Walmart seemingly was a fiduciary. And if we determined that Walmart was a fiduciary, why wouldn't we remand the case back to the district court? Because the district court's opinion was predicated on a conclusion that Walmart was not acting as a fiduciary.
Well, Your Honor, I think first and foremost, as a conversion issue that you initially asked about, ERISA contains no disclosure obligation for conversion notices, as this court held in Walker v. FedEx, which was authored by Your Honor and joined by Judge Moore, and also in the Vest v. Resolute case, which I do acknowledge Judge Tranch dissented in. But the court has held on each of the occasions it's had to consider the issue that there is no obligation to provide conversion notices to plan participants as to their right to convert a life insurance policy.
Every case is not the same. I mean, we look at the plan documents, the summary plan description. We look at the course of dealing between the parties and other factors. And even if we're making a determination based on ERISA and the plan requirements, there's at least an argument to be made in this case that Walmart had a fiduciary duty to give notice.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree in that the SPD clearly provides that participants of their conversion rights. If you look at page ID 250 and also page ID 795, it states that the optional life insurance chapter, that is the life insurance chapter, it says that the participants have 31 days to convert their life insurance policy into an individual policy. And the other aspect of this is that at the time of Mr. Chelf's death, there was no life insurance policy to convert because he had failed to timely make the premium payments. And so if there is no policy to convert, there can be no obligation to provide a notice of conversion rights.
Here's a little bit.
I thought what was going on here was that in the administrative record, there was a copy of the plan, and the terms of the plan actually said that Walmart was required, that the plan terms required Walmart to provide notice of the right to convert. But the plaintiff would not have prevailed on that below because of Walmart's argument that particular claim was forfeited. And then we get into the problem of whether the plaintiff should have asked reconsideration or asked the district court to amend the opinion, because the administrative record came to light before judgment had been entered, but after the court had rendered the memorandum opinion. Wasn't that the scenario that unfolded in the district court?
In part, Your Honor. The provision that Mr. Grabhorn referenced is actually not found in the summary plan description issued by the Walmart defendants or the administrative committee. It's found in the life insurance policy issued to Walmart by Prudential. And in fact,
don't plan documents govern over summary plan descriptions as a matter of law?
Yes, Your Honor. However, the Third Circuit, I believe, in Bicknell versus Lockheed Martin, considered the very same policy at issue with the identical provisions or nearly identical provisions, and held that there was no obligation to provide notice of conversion rights in that case, evaluating essentially the same policy.
Here's my concern. Your briefing and the argument that we've had basically here today leans on that issue, that one key notice issue. But let's put that aside. Let's assume you maybe won on that issue. The problem is there are a whole series of other claims in this complaint that rely on a fiduciary obligation in the management of plan assets that is not tied to the submittal of notice in this one issue. And I don't see much argument about that in your briefing. And I think it's key, the key question being, when Walmart exercised discretionary authority or discretionary control respecting management of the plan assets or distribution of the plan assets, is that not a classic breach of fiduciary duty claim?
I believe that, again, we have to look at the nature of the benefits at issue. I would certainly agree with you, your analysis, with respect to a self-funded benefit plan. However, in this case, the activity of collection of premium payments is defined by the DOL interpretive bulletin that was mentioned earlier as a ministerial as opposed to fiduciary activity.
No, wait, you're taking the position that management and use and disposition of plan assets is not a fiduciary duty relative to a non-self-funded plan?
No, Your Honor.
I have litigation about that stuff all the time.
No, Your Honor. What I was saying was that the premiums themselves would be that they're actually assets of Prudential as opposed to the plan.
How can they be assets of Prudential if you withhold them from employees' paychecks?
Well, they're used to pay the premiums, and Your Honor, they're actually. I think we need to step back here because there was no money withheld from Mr. Chell's paychecks. He was not receiving paychecks. He was on long-term disability benefits. And because he was on long-term disability benefits, there was no money withheld. And the plan notified
Mr. Chell. There's money held in his account for due vacation pay, earned vacation pay, which is an asset held not by these insurance companies. It's held by Walmart.
But that money was not earmarked for benefits, nor was it withheld for premium payments. What that was accrued paid time off that he received as while he was on long-term disability.
Does Walmart's rules then say that that can be used toward payment of premiums?
It can once it is issued to the participant. However, the check's not issued to the participant except at the end of the year. There's specific intervals when those checks are issued to the participants. And what the SPD actually notifies participants of, in the long-term disability section, there is a section for reference. This is the 2016 page benefit booklet, and it is page ID 827. And it goes on to page ID. What it says is that if you wish to continue medical, dental, vision, accidental, death, and disability optional, associate, and dependent life insurance policies while you're receiving LTD benefits, you must make premium payments each pay period. These amounts will not be deducted from your long-term disability benefit payments. If you fail to pay your premiums for other benefit plans, your benefits may be canceled. And it said that, now it does say.
And then did the plan policy, was that the document that waived premiums in the event of short or long-term disability, which is pretty standard? Once you go on the disability, the premiums are waived. Is that correct?
The only premiums that are waived, there's something called a short-term disability enhanced policy, which waives those premiums for a short period of, I'm not exactly sure the time, but let's say it's around 10 weeks. Mr. Chelf was on long-term disability for a number of years. But what the plan does say is that while you're on disability, that the premium obligations for long-term disability and short-term disability are waived. However, all other benefit premiums must be paid. And that's very specific in the handbooklet, and it says it multiple times.
So if you withheld payments for non-owed disability policies, would that not be a use or disposition of plan assets?
There were no such payments withheld, Your Honor. There were no such payments withheld. And it's actually the member's obligation to remit the payments each pay period. And in fact, the administrative record that Walmart submitted to the court, which the court did not review, indicates that Mr. Chelf and his family received several notices that his premium payments were in arrears. And in fact, his family wound up paying those on a couple of occasions. And so to say that he didn't owe the premium payments, based on, while I know the administrative record was not considered by the court, however, this court can't affirm on any basis in the record. And the administrative record indicates that the Chelf family on multiple occasions received letters indicating the premium payments were in arrears, and that they in fact made a couple premium payments during that time frame. However, they ultimately failed to remit premium payments for a period of around 8 or 9 months. And then they simply failed to make the premium payments in accordance with the plan policy. And the SPD, as indicated before, states in numerous places that while on disability or leave of absence, it is the participant's obligation to continue making regular premium payments, which was not done. And the reason is, as Your Honor pointed out, that they are not withheld from the members' paychecks, because said paychecks aren't issued by Walmart, but they're disability checks issued by the insurer of the long-term disability plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Grabholm? You're on mute.
Apologies. Thank you for letting me know. I'm going to start back with, I believe it was along the first line of question that Judge Strange had about CFR 250975-8 and its limitation. I do agree that it is limited to those who are not, don't have any control or authority over the plan, which is not the case here. Moreover, in the answer, the regulation specifically excludes Section 21A of ERISA, which defines what a fiduciary is. And that goes back to, again, the collection and handling of premiums or plan assets. So I'd posit, again, just as in our brief, the 29 CFR 2509-75-8 is inapplicable. And in regards to what Mr. Howard said with what the court really decided, and what the court latched onto was that specific regulation, because the court ultimately concluded that what Walmart was doing here wasn't really acting as a fiduciary, or their action specific to this wasn't that as a fiduciary, but it was an administrative function. But again, as soon as you get into controlling plan assets, i.e. premiums, then you're inherently acting as a fiduciary. To say that the plan assets or the premiums are the property of Prudential, no, they're a plan asset, because the plan is the one who's being funded for the policy itself. And then as to Mr. Howard's comment on Bicknell, I would note that while I do agree that the court there considered the same language as here, again, that's a Third Circuit case. And in that case, the facts were kind of odd. The person became ineligible for their dependents' benefits. So father had benefits for their son, who became ineligible for the benefits based upon his age. And I think the year was 2003. The father didn't, or the son didn't pass away until 2006. It was 3 years later. And Bicknell latched onto the 90-day limitation that was in the policy. And here, Mr. Chelf passed away within a month of when any sort of ineligibility date could have applied. And the policy specifically contains language that allows Mr. Chelf to convert when that happens without these sort of limitation or anything. So no limitation here would be applicable, as it was in Bicknell. And then lastly, the only other thing I want to add would be a lot of what Mr. Howard said relating to what the premiums were, where they came from, how all this is working hand in hand, is inherently questions of fact. And the arguments of counsel and statements of counsel today are not evidence. That's been upheld by this court multiple times. And I would posit that those are issues that will come to light in discovery. And absent such discovery, I don't know that we can get there today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. And the case may be submitted. And the clerk, you may adjourn from the television or video argument, and the clerk may prepare the next case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.